Hey, it's Francis Lam. You know, we end the show every week with credits for our producers, but now I want to start by thanking you. You know, we're a listener-supported show, and we literally can't make it without you. So if you like what you hear, please head to splendidtable.org and click that donate button. Thank you. And here's this week's show. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for curious cooks and eaters. You've heard the mantra, know where your food comes from. So for a lot of people, that's a command to get to know farmers and cooks and come home with cage-free eggs. But I often think of it as the key to finding stories. Because everywhere you look, up and down the food chain, you can find fascinating, world-changing details. And later this hour, we'll talk with a forager who harvests wild plants for food, but really does it to figure out the character of the place where he lives. We'll learn how some fish get hot or not. And right now, we're going to talk about how chicken may have doomed life on Earth and how it might save it. So I'm exaggerating, but maybe only a little, because Maren McKenna is a tremendous journalist who happens to have one of the scariest specialties I can imagine. She's an expert on superbugs, bacteria that has evolved to survive antibiotics. I followed her work for years, to be honest, mostly with like my hands over my eyes, but her research brought her to a place that I couldn't ignore. Chicken. Because, as she's found, it's the chicken industry that we can mostly blame for our enormous overuse of antibiotics. But as she followed the story of Big Chicken, Maren also found a real reason for hope. So hi, Maren. So great to have you here today.
I am so excited to talk to you.
I am too, although I'm a little terrified, to be honest. But okay, well, let's start. So you have this idea that once raising chickens stopped being about growing animals and became more about growing meat, the industry basically became this like laboratory of technological innovation. And I love this story of how 50 or 60 years ago, there was a contest to create what they were calling the chicken of tomorrow. So what in their minds was the chicken of tomorrow?
First, thank you for doing the sound effect behind that, because that is exactly what I hear in my head when I think of the chicken of tomorrow. So in order to understand the chicken of tomorrow, which is actually the chicken that we eat right now, you have to think about what chickens were like in the chicken of yesterday, which would have been the chickens outside the back doors of our grandparents or great-grandparents. They would have been mostly chickens that were there to lay eggs. And they would, for the most part, have been eaten after their egg-laying days were done, which means that they would have had several years of running around a barnyard or a backyard after chicks, flapping up into trees, pecking around for insects and so forth. And while that all that exercise and diet might have made them very rich tasting, it would also have made them kind of scrawny and stringy. And in order to get people to eat more chicken, which was the entire goal of this, was to increase the demand for chicken because industrialization was already increasing the supply of chicken. The USDA and the A&P supermarket chain held this contest, the goal of which was to physically remake the chicken, to hybridize chickens from those varieties of backyard chicken all over the country so that they would be first white-feathered, because that was more appealing to consumers, and docile, not running around a barnyard, but willing to sit in one place, but most of all, meaty. When they proposed the contest, they talked about breasts you could slice like a steak, which not only sounds delicious, but also gives you a sense of what a chicken breast must have been like before this contest. And out of the chicken of tomorrow, that marks the transition from chickens as a backyard thing or as heritage varieties that differ from town to town and ecosystem to ecosystem to one consistent chicken really all over the world that looks the same, gains weight in the same manner, has the same temperament and the same sort of body composition, and produces all that meat that is now the number one meat that we eat in America.
And so to get to that point where you have chicken as the number one meat, they had to make all these technological innovations to keep making the growing of chicken faster and more efficient and cheaper. And maybe the most important one, you write about is that the chicken industry was the first industry to introduce antibiotics to the animals, which no one had done before. Why did they start doing that?
There's a pretty interesting nexus of a couple of, I guess you could say, a couple of different trends happening, and they all happen at the end of World War II. The first is that antibiotics come on the market. All of the antibiotics that we think of as starting the antibiotic era arrive between about 1944 and 1948. And they make an enormous social impact. They change the course of the war. They bring soldiers and sailors back that otherwise would have died on the battlefield. And the war also marks a huge upsurge in the infrastructure of growing meat so that all those soldiers and sailors can be fed. But when the war ends, that guaranteed market goes away, and the meat industry suddenly needs, in order to keep from collapsing, to cut its costs really sharply. So they start using much cheaper feed. And then they start looking for supplements that they can add to that cheap feed in order to make it more nutritious. And this rogue scientist, Thomas Jukes, who's a specialist in the dietary needs of chickens and who happens to work for one of the companies that made one of these first antibiotics, gets the idea to try dosing chickens with tiny, tiny doses of antibiotic in their feed. And when he conducts an experiment in 1948 to figure out if this is going to work, he gives a set of chickens all kinds of different supplements. And the ones that get the tiny doses of antibiotics grow faster than any of the others.
Wait, so why do antibiotics make the chickens grow faster? Because they're not hormones. They're not growth hormones.
Right. Antibiotics are compounds made by bacteria to kill other bacteria. That's what they were originally before we took them into the lab and synthesized them and made them more perfect. So we give antibiotics to animals in their feed and water. So they're swallowed, they go into the guts, and then they affect the community of bacteria that exist in the guts of animals and every living thing in such a way that it changes their uptake of nutrition. And it makes them put on tasty muscle mass faster than they otherwise would.
Huh. And why is it a problem?
Well, it's a problem for a whole nested set of reasons. It's a problem first because most of those antibiotics aren't being given to animals that are sick. And in human medicine, we take for granted that antibiotics exist in order to cure something. But most of the use in agriculture isn't to cure anything. It's for these other uses. The second is that as we start to give antibiotics to animals, it gives us kind of a new framework to think about the way we raise them that undermines animal welfare, sure, that causes farms to be more concentrated, that changes the economics of farms, the balance between industry and labor. But the most important reason that we should be concerned about this is because when antibiotics are given to animals in that manner, it causes antibiotic-resistant bacteria to arise and flourish in their guts, in that collection of bacteria that lives in the guts of every animal and every other living thing, including us. And those antibiotic-resistant bacteria then exit the animal, either on its meat when it gets disassembled at slaughter, or in its manure, which then goes into the farm environment. And one way or another, through various pathways, those drug-resistant bacteria travel to humans and cause drug-resistant infections.
But you also write in your book that, I don't know if it's a happy ending, but maybe a hopeful ending, which is that it seems that the chicken industry, which started this, may actually be helping to lead us out of it. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, it's a really lovely and sort of surprising symmetry in this long history of making this mistake. Starting about 4 years ago, poultry producers, led by the company Purdue Farms, which are the fourth largest chicken company in America, started to turn away from routine antibiotic use. The head of Purdue, Jim Purdue, the grandson of the founder, actually called a press conference in Washington in 2014 and announced that his company had decided to go as close to antibiotic-free as they could. And now, 3 years later, they are very, very close. And after Purdue came so many other poultry production companies and food service companies, you know, Purdue and then Tyson, Chick-fil-A and then McDonald's, Costco and Walmart, and a whole suite of fast food chains all announced that they were going to pursue antibiotic-free chicken. The backdrop to all of this, the reason why this happened, the sort of proximate reason, is that there was a change in regulations around antibiotic use in agriculture in the U.S. But the real reason, I believe, is that consumers were turning against antibiotic use and were speaking up to companies and saying, we don't want to spend our food dollars on this anymore. We want you to find a different way.
I hate that I'd be naive, but it really is something like enough people just said, I don't want to eat chicken with antibiotics. I don't want to feed that to my kids. That's really why they changed?
I really think so. So Purdue says that before they made this change, they were getting 3,000 comments from their customers a month through various channels asking about antibiotic use. And before that company made this change and started the snowball rolling, there were very large healthcare systems like the University of California and very large school systems like the Chicago Public Schools that were saying to the meat production industry, we're going to change our buying. We're not going to spend our money on this anymore. And when buyers that large speak to big companies listen.
Yeah. And so the hope here is that through our, meaning us, the consumers, we can keep demanding this and our producers will respond and they can show how you can have these industries without this practice. Thank you so much, Marin, for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Marin McKenna is the author of Big Chicken, the incredible story of how antibiotics created modern agriculture and changed the way the world eats. So, you know, I have to say, it's easy. It's so easy to be cynical and to feel hopeless about our food system sometimes. And so, to me, it's incredibly energizing to hear stories like Marin's, that you can really vote with your dollars, and even enormous industrial chicken companies can make huge and maybe world-changing choices just because ordinary people showed them what we want. So I just finished editing a book by a guy named Sam Cass about that idea. And Sam was a chef, but he was also Barack Obama's senior advisor on food policy. So he's seen how the sausage gets made. And the big thing he took away from his years in the White House is that government is powerful, but the real power is in the everyday choices that regular people make. And what that means for us is that basically, you don't have to worry about being a perfect eater. You don't have to go vegan. All you need to do is to make a few choices today, or this week, or this month, that are just a little better than what you did before. And so in terms of sustainability, for instance, eating pork, it's a little better than eating beef. And eating chicken is a little better than pork. And fish is a little better than that. And of course, vegetables and beans are better than that. But what that means is if you skip a burger like today and have a chicken sandwich instead, you're already doing a little better. And all those little choices add up. Coming up, beets are magic.
Beet's sweetness is actually the result of a winter survival strategy. The sugars in beets act like antifreeze. They bring the freezing point of the fluid within, like the water that's in beets, down, so it's harder for it to freeze. And that prevents their cells from rupturing due to ice crystals in colder weather.
We'll be back. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for curious cooks and eaters. I once read a story in the LA Times about the forager Pascal Baudard. You know, so foraging for wild food can be a little dangerous. You have to watch out for poisonous plants, you have to watch out for bears and snakes. But Pascal was out in the woods one day, and he swears he saw a zombie. Like running around looking for brains kind of zombie. And Pascal forages in Los Angeles. So he looked again, and sure enough, there was a cameraman following the zombie, and so everything was all right. But these days, Pascal isn't talking about the undead, but the rebirth he's seeing in native and wild plants after the wildfires in that area. He sat down to chat about what it means to be a forager with our friend Russ Parsons.
Tell us a little bit about the foraging you do and then how you got into it.
So how I got into it, I pretty much grew up that way in Belgium. I grew up, you know, tiny little town, maybe like 1,000 people, farming town. And my grandma used to send me sometime into the forest and say, can you get me some nettles or walnuts or hazelnuts? So that's what got me into foraging. I never had this conception of being disconnected from nature from that perspective. There is always food everywhere, really. What I really do is actually study the flavor of a landscape or of an environment. So I can do that in California. I do it in Vermont. Sometimes I go back to Belgium. My passion is really to discover what is the taste of a location.
Can you give us some examples? Like here in Southern California, what are some of the things that you collect?
Oh my God, there is so many different things. You know, for example, mustard. We have mustard everywhere. Nobody does anything with mustard here in Los Angeles. People don't think about it as something edible. They're all edible. So a good one, for example, would be the black mustard, which is really super invasive too. You can make the most incredible Dijon mustard. But you can also go for other plants like, you know, here in my hand, I have like a mountain vinegar. And it's basically a vinegar that I make myself. I make my own cider with manzanita berries. And then I change it into vinegar. And then I infuse it with pinyon pine, mushroom, all kinds of different wild berries. And if you smell it, it completely smells like the mountain. People absolutely like go crazy on that one. So it's one way to take a look at the environment and kind of research the flavor. And being able to create condiments out of it.
What are some of the other ways that you preserve and that you capture these flavors?
Last time I counted like 16 different methods of food preservation. You can make wine, I make sodas, I make infusion. I can turn all the drinks that I make into vinegar. I can make sauce, condiments. Last week I was making some oyster mushroom ketchup. I can do an infinity of product, really.
Where do you collect these things? Do you have favorite hunting grounds for them?
You know, what you're looking for really dictates the environment that you're looking for it. I probably have 2,000 acres of private property. So I do all my foraging on private property. And if it's not native, then I don't care. You know, I can go into a place and pick up dandelion. Nobody wants dandelion. And by the way, 90% of the thing that I collect are actually non-native because the native stuff is usually very strong. So I look at foraging. Foraging can be controversial a little bit, but I look at foraging as one way to actually help the environment in the same time.
And are you in coastal plains? Are you in hills?
I'm like all over the place. You know, if I want to make my mountain vinegar, there's a, my friend called Gloria has a whole property and she has what, 60 acres of pinyon pine and white fir. And so I just go over there and collect whatever I need. Close to Los Angeles, I have some friend who have also property in the Angeles Forest.
All those hillside properties, though, I mean, everybody knows this winter was just horrible as far as wildfires. Were you affected by that?
Yeah, pretty much lost everything. So what I used to do here in the Los Angeles forest, I had on that property, I used to have my wild food garden. So I had a beer garden that I created with native plant. I had a spice garden that I created with native plant. It's all gone. So, you know, in the same time, I took a look at it. I'm going like, okay, how can I use that to be more creative?
Can you tell us the first time you went back after the fires? What did you see?
There's nothing. I mean, there was like nothing. I've never seen something like that before. It's just completely black. You know, some of the bigger trees are still there. The oak tree are okay. They survived this kind of fire. But there was nothing left. I've never seen something like that. And the smell, it was like bacon. It smelled like bacon. There was smoke everywhere. Yeah, it was scary a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, but the interesting part is I really, and I'm not a botanist, you know, but from my perspective, I'm really seeing the native plant coming back and not the non-native plant, which is interesting. So the environment is kind of cleaning itself to some degree. And I see much more native plant growing right now than ever before.
Oh, that's fascinating.
So it's interesting, yeah. You have like a lot of plants like mugwort, which is showing up, wild hyacinths, California sagebrush, giant nettles. So this is all like native plants that are really taking off, and a lot of grass too, you know. Mm-hmm. So the hillside are actually turning green right now. It's interesting. In the old days, people used to do that on purpose. You know, it was a process of regeneration. So I'm still learning. It's a fantastic learning process to actually, you know, as horrible as it was, I'm looking at it more from an educational experience and see what I can, you know, learn from it.
Oh, thank you, Pascal. It's wonderful.
Well, thank you so much. It was a pleasure to be here.
Pascal Baudard is the author of The Wildcrafting Brewer and The New Wildcrafted Cuisine. Russ Parsons is the author of How to Pick a Peach. So rebirth in the forest, and now let's talk about rebirth in the sea. With spring on its way, I was thinking about the fish that start to come out of the water this time of year, and so I wanted to talk to the seafood scholar Barton Seaver. But since he just wrote a massive, definitive guide to American seafood, it turns out that our chat could not be contained by one mere season. In fact, Seaver needed to bring us all the way back to the beginnings of America to talk about how our tastes for fish have changed over time.
Well, America's relationship with seafood is utterly fascinating in that it was the first economy upon which this country was founded and upon which we took our first steps towards economic and political freedom. I mean, it was religious freedom that drew the first few settlers here, but it was really the economics and a lot of that drawn off of the backs of cod and those who fished them in the northwestern Atlantic that really provided that first sort of siren call. But funny enough, eating seafood has always been somewhat beneath our aspirations. And this sort of starts off with a quote from William Bradford, the first governor of Plymouth Colony, back in 1623 in a plaintive letter back home. He writes, "If ye land afford ye bread, and ye sea ye'll do fish, rest you while a-contented. God will one day afford you better fare." there was a real trepidation, but also just a real bias against this. And despite the fact that we came here seeking religious freedom, we didn't necessarily bring with us a lot of religious tolerance. And in the Catholic calendar, there's over 150 fast days at that time that required the devout to abstain from meat. And so seafood was first off seen as a food of the Catholics, which are from our Protestant beginnings was, you know, they were the others. And throughout our history of immigration, which is the story of America, oftentimes these new waves of immigrants were coming from cultures where seafood was a mainstay of the cuisine. Mm-hmm. And further, when we hit World War I, World War II, you know, there are all these campaigns to save meat, eat fish. They feed themselves, you know, to save the products of the land so that we can send them over to the boys overseas. And so Victory Gardens was one means to sort of inspire the citizenry. But seafood also became a food and asset to victory. The problem with that, though, is that once the seasoning of patriotism was removed with the clanging bells of armistice, our preference for seafood again sort of diminished. And so there's sort of been this history of seafood being seen as a penance or something you do for sacrifice. And that's also borne out in the fact that we've only ever eaten about 15 pounds of seafood per person per year in this country. Mm. And compare
like
that to
like
over
chicken.
Over 200 pounds, 225 even, of meat, beef, pork, chicken, and lamb, turkey. Oui. It's just not our preferred food.
It is obviously cultural. You know, I certainly come from a culture that really reveres seafood. And as I understand it in your history, there are definitely fish that have become extremely popular through the years. But then, like, the subject of fashion. So what are some reasons that certain fish might become popular? And why do some fish stop being delicious to us?
Well, first, when we're talking about wild fisheries, this is nature. There are fluctuations. And so some seafoods like bluefish, which sort of bears the albatross of sort of widespread disdain. Bluefish was once an incredibly popular, very important, very valuable seafood that just disappeared from the waters, not necessarily because of overfishing, but just because of sort of decadal fluctuations in population biomass. And part of the shifting in preference for seafood is that really before the early 1900s, seafood was caught by small boat regional fisheries. With the exception of the North Atlantic fleet that was really catching this abundance of cod, small boat fleets, whether it was the Greek fishery for shrimp, octopus, sponge even, which they didn't eat, out of Florida, whether it was the Portuguese coming out of Bedford in areas a little bit south, the Chinese immigrants that settled along the West Coast that brought with them their own preferences, fishing methods, even boat design, the Chinese junk, it was called. And so during this phase, preference was based on regional availability. But after the early 1900s, when technology really took over, when the diesel engine allowed massive nets to be towed through the water to indiscriminately catch whatever was in its path, the small boat fishery never was to regain prominence in the economy of fishing. And we've evermore moved towards just sort of a very limited scope of species.
I mean, some of these individual species have some pretty crazy stories about why they became popular one day and not the next. Can you tell us about tilefish?
Yeah, tilefish was discovered in the late 1800s by a captain named Captain Kirby, who was fishing in deeper waters than was normal, doing an experimental fishery. And up came about 5,000 pounds of tilefish, a fish never before seen. And they immediately sent one down to the galley and cooked it up, and everyone present declared it to be one of the finest fish they'd ever tasted. And so this new discovery was brought to the attention of the American public. Captains began targeting it, and it became the darling of the culinary scene in America. In much the same way that, like, Patagonian toothfish, also known as Chilean sea bass, or orange roughy, suddenly found these, you know, sort of astronomical rise to the top of every menu, so too did tilefish. But what's amazing is 3 years later, just 3 years later, there was an event that happened where there was an inversion of cold water, it's believed, that trapped all the tilefish and killed them. And this is a naturally occurring event. And steamships going back and forth from Europe, from Boston all the way down through Norfolk, reported passing through tens of square miles of ocean completely covered in dead tilefish. And it was decades before tilefish was seen again in the fisheries, and it was further decades before it was of any abundance. But by the time it returned to market, well, it had fallen from our graces, and we had moved on to new favorites, and tilefish has never regained the popularity it once enjoyed.
As you said, there are so many biomass fluctuations and changes of water currents that can cause a population of fish to explode or decrease, but that also gets me thinking about seasonality. Most fish do have seasons, right?
Absolutely. Coming up into spring, as we are right now, there's a lot of attention being paid to seafood. Why? Well, going back to the beginning of this conversation, Lent. I mean, this is when most seafood is eaten in America, this and right around Christmas. Mm. You know, this is when the waters come alive. This is when the water's warm and masses of fish began to make their migration toward shore, oftentimes to spawn. And then to begin their sort of summer's long predatory indulgences that fattens them towards fall. And this is an exciting season, but not necessarily one that offers us the best quality fish.
Right, because they've already spent a lot of the fat that they built up over the winter.
Exactly. Well, and one of my favorite fish, mackerel, which I fish quite a lot in my harbor, has been described in spring as slack in richness, stale in flavor, and wretched skeletons at their worst. Whoa. Okay.
That's cold, man.
Yeah. I know. Well, their fat content can drop down to as low as 2%, whereas in their fattest form, they're up to over 20% fat in that richness and luxuriousness. That's not to say they're not worth eating, but then there's other species that come into our culinary canon in the spring that are the pinnacle of things that we celebrate. On the East Coast, we have the striped bass. Over in the Pacific Northwest, we have, you know, up in Alaska, the Copper River salmon, you know, America's most famous sort of branded provenance of fish, you know, and that happens about May 15th every year or so, that fishery opens up. So there's a lot of things in spring to really celebrate. Shad roe, shrimp opens up down in the Gulf. There's a lot there, and it only gets better through the summer.
Right. All right. Thanks a lot, Barton.
Thanks, Francis. Great talking to you.
Barton Seaver is the author of American Seafood, and he left us with a recipe for shrimp al ajillo. It's Spanish garlic shrimp. You can find it at splendidtable.org. The beet is the king of vegetables. Don't at me. But no, seriously, I can't think of anything in the world that gives you the same mix of sweetness and just delicious, dirty earthiness as a good beet. So I am on Team Beet for life. They're so good, but honestly, like, how many beet and goat cheese salads can you have in a life? So here's our producer, Sally Swift, talking with Molly Birnbaum from America's Test Kitchen about their great new take on the beet salad.
Hey, Molly, great to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
Have you noticed how many cooked, prepackaged beets are showing up in produce departments? They're everywhere.
Yeah, they really are.
In little vacuum packs. Well, I have a prediction to make that beet salads are back big time.
They are everywhere, beet salads.
And it seems to me the thing that makes a beet salad really, really great is the cheese. Mm-hmm. Which, do you have a theory about why that works?
Well, beets and goat cheese have always gone well together, and there is a reason. I mean, beets are really nice and earthy and sweet, and pairing that with a tangy, creamy, salty cheese, that pairing is just one that, you know, really works.
Yeah, it's really divine. Hey, I have a really kind of dumb question, but what makes a beet sweet?
Well, beet's sweetness is actually the result of a winter survival strategy. The sugars in beets act like antifreeze. And that means that they bring the freezing point of the fluid within, like the water that's in beets, down. So it's harder for it to freeze. And that prevents their cells from rupturing due to ice crystals in colder weather.
That is a crazy story. I never knew that.
Yeah, and there are some other vegetables that can do the same thing. Like kale is actually much sweeter after a freeze if it's still outgrowing.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I've experienced that in my own garden. Mm-hmm. So I want to go back to those beet salads because I know you guys took on a beet salad recipe to try to make it perfect. Can you tell me what you looked at?
Yes. So we developed a charred beet salad over at America's Test Kitchen, and it is amazing, I have to say. And it's a little bit of a twist on the regular beet salad. So there are traditionally beets and goat cheese. For this salad, we didn't go with the goat cheese route. Instead, we decided to mix up some feta cheese and Greek yogurt. So it still has that tangy, salty creaminess, but it's a little bit different. And then for the beets themselves, we actually give you two options. Whole beets, they take a long time to cook, and it's hard to get them totally even. So one good option for cooking beets is actually sous vide cooking, or putting them in a plastic bag, taking out all the air, and cooking them in a low-temperature water bath. You do that for around 4 hours at 190 degrees. You get beets that are perfectly cooked all the way through.
So if you've gotten a sous vide stick, this is what you need to be doing with it.
Exactly. It's the perfect first recipe for your new sous vide circulator. But if you don't have one, roasting is an excellent option.
And the thing that I noticed about your recipe that I thought was really interesting is that you're actually re-roasting the cooked beet. Is that true?
We are charring the beets. So after the beets are totally cooked, you peel them and cut them into rounds, and then we're charring them in a hot skillet with a little bit of oil. And what that's doing is basically burning off some of the sugar, so it's adding a nice bitter note to what is otherwise pretty uniformly sweet, and that adds a lot of depth to the flavor of the salad.
Which pairs beautifully with that cheese, as you said.
Exactly. And then we also add some radicchio, which is likewise bitter and complements the bitterness of the charred beets, and pomegranate seeds, which add a nice bright pop of acidity. It's delicious.
So, Molly, what do you use to dress those charred beets?
That's a great question because it's actually a really interesting component. So when we're roasting the beets, we're adding a little bit of water and oil and sherry vinegar and salt and pepper to the packet in which we roast it. So you're creating an aluminum foil packet around the beets to roast them that contains a little bit of liquid. And when you're done roasting it, you use that liquid for the dressing because it's filled with this delicious beet flavor. And all you need to do is add a little bit of yogurt and you get this creamy, flavorful beet dressing ready made.
That is so smart. The other thing you guys do that I found was really interesting is that you pair like interesting green herbs at the end of that recipe. You use both dill and tarragon.
Well, the fresh dill and tarragon add this really nice fresh herbal flavor to the salad. And what we really wanted to do here was combine all of these different kind of taste sensations, the sweetness and the bitterness of the beets and the radicchio, the creamy and the salty of the feta and the goat cheese, the acid and brightness of the pomegranate, and then the freshness of the herbs. And those all come together to create really a perfect salad.
That just sounds delicious. And you know, beets are so sturdy, they can really take all of that. Molly, thanks for coming in.
Thanks so much for having me.
Molly Birnbaum is the executive editor of Science at America's Test Kitchen. You can find that recipe for charred beet salad at splendidtable.org. And coming up, I get to talk to you. And Alpana Singh tells us about her path to becoming a master sommelier. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for curious cooks and eaters. All right, let's talk, you and me. You can always call us 1-800-537-5252, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And here we go. Here's Helena from Minneapolis. Hey, Helena.
Hi. So I have a situation. It's going to sound ridiculous, but I've been cooking for my boyfriend a couple dinners now, and it's really awkward because after doing Mexican one night and Indian one night and a Southeast Asian one night and throwing cilantro into everything, he was honest with me about the fact that he tastes that soapy taste that some people get.
Oh.
And, you know, he was in there. He was choking it down, you know, trying to not make waves. And I feel terrible, but I've been trying to sub in things like maybe parsley or mint, but I'm looking for some advice, so.
Oh, no. Oh,
yeah.
No. Well, actually, wait, time out. Like, real talk. 3 dinners before he said something?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that's pretty good. Like, that dude, I mean, I would have just gently tried to, you know, politely say like, oh, I actually can't eat that, like within the first 4 minutes. So
yeah, I know. I mean, I'm pretty impressed too.
Right on. Okay. So what can you substitute for cilantro? This is sort of an age old question, and I'm sorry to say I've never found a truly great answer for it. Because cilantro does have such a unique and specific flavor. I would say you can try a couple of things. There is an herb called culantro.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a typo. It's just CU. Otherwise, it's the same thing. Sometimes it's called sawleaf herb, and it's because it's a long blade. Like the leaf, you know, it's like a long sort of broad blade, and it has saws on the edge. It's a little tricky to find, but it has a flavor very much like cilantro, and I don't know if it has the same whatever chemical compound it is in cilantro that makes people taste cilantro as being soapy. So I would say maybe see if you can get your hands on some culantro. Usually you'll find that either in like Latin or Caribbean markets or stores or Southeast Asian markets if you have any near you, and see if that does a trick for you. Because if it does, I think that's a great substitute. If that doesn't work, it's really a different flavor, but it might be a happy medium. I would think about using celery leaves.
Oh, you know, that makes sense.
You know what I mean? Because it has a sort of that sort of like high, sort of like medicinal, but like in a nice way flavor.
Yeah.
And these are literally, when you buy the bunch of celery, just get the ones that don't have that top lopped off, that actually have the leaves stuck to the stalks, and use those as an herb. I would also say maybe it's a thing where you can make the dish and just leave the cilantro on the side.
There you go.
See how that goes.
Fantastic. Now, this culantro, is that something that would be easy to grow, or is that something I really have to find at a market?
Oh, I have like the blackest thumb. So,
okay.
So I truly have no idea. If your first instinct would be like, hey, can I grow that? I'm assuming you've got a pretty good green thumb thing going on. So I would definitely look into it.
Cool. Awesome.
And again, all's fails. Keep cooking the food. And, you know, just keep a little stash of cilantro for yourself.
Perfect. Thanks so much, Francis.
Cool. Thank you. Take care.
All right. You too.
All right. We have Adam on the line. Hey, Adam. How's it going?
Good. Thank you. How are you doing today, Francis?
I'm well, thanks. Where are you calling from?
So I'm calling from Framingham, Massachusetts today.
Oh, right on. Welcome, Framingham. What should
thank
we talk
you.
About?
Well, so I love American food in general, but my father was a big fan of Costa Rica. He spoke fluent Spanish, and he really loved the culture there, and likewise introduced me to it, too. I'm a vegetarian, so rice and beans is very much in my daily diet. So
sure.
I'm just wondering what I can do to replace both the flavor that is imparted to many of these dishes with like pork and those sorts of meats. And I know it's not necessarily just for flavor, too. They use it a lot for, like, that fattiness, if you will. And I'm just wondering if there's anything I can do to amp up like rice and beans, and likewise some like Mexican sauces like mole, for example, to get that fattiness and that flavor, or at least the deepness of the flavor anyway.
Sure. So I would think first of replacing the fat. How can you get more fat into your beans that you're missing if you're not adding the pork? In this case, you can certainly just, you know, add a little of olive oil or, you know, whatever cooking oil you like, just to give it a little bit more heft, a little more richness. Butter obviously is not exactly the same as pork fat, but it has a has that richness to it. You might find this flavor of butter a little bit, I wouldn't say too strong, because it's butter, it's delicious, you know, like, but, you know, maybe you feel like it's too dominant. So maybe a little butter and a little bit of oil, you know, you just kind of add a little bit of body, a little bit of that richness. If you're thinking about replacing the smokiness of a smoked pork in a pot of beans, there are lots of things you can do. I love Spanish smoked paprika, pimentón. It has a lovely flavor of its own, but you can just get that smokiness from it, and you can just add a little bit of that smoke aroma with that if you use it gently. Or if you're cooking something Mexican, grab a bottle of mezcal. I mean, mezcal is, I'm dead serious, just like put a glug or two. I mean, that smokiness of mezcal is so intense in it, and because it's an alcohol, you know, alcohol can actually combine with flavors like tomato and like weave its way through. It's sort of like, it acts as a sort of bond. And so it actually pulls like the flavor molecules through the sauce in a really particular way. That's why like there's a different cuisine, but like when you have vodka sauce, like a pasta with vodka sauce, like that's why the vodka's right there. It's not so you can taste the vodka, it's because it actually pulls other flavors through the tomato.
Okay.
So I would think about that. Grab yourself some mezcal, grab yourself some smoked paprika, and maybe be handy with butter. Or like, you know, coconut oil, you know, you know, that's still solid in the jar, you know, that you can that in and it'll emulsify, it'll give it some richness. So I would look at those things.
Sounds great. Looks like I can have some cocktails while I'm making rice and beans too. It takes long enough to make, so that sounds great to me.
Make sure you're still standing when it's time to eat, but yeah.
Well, thank you. That sounds so great.
Yeah, have fun. Enjoy.
Will do.
All right, so the other day, I was writing something and I realized I have been a food writer, a professional food writer, for 15 years, and I have never once spelled hors d'oeuvres right on the first try. So I did what a writer does with this newfound wisdom, and which is to say I like procrastinated by tweeting it, and it was like I opened the door to all kinds of liberated admissions from non-spellers.
I'm Allison, and I have a mental block on how to spell accommodations. Did I mention I'm a guidebook writer?
Cappuccino, and I'm an Italian citizen.
Hi, I'm Lauren. I'm a former speech and debate teacher, and now I work at the National Speech and Debate Association. Some words you think I'd be able to spell correctly are recommendation, extemporaneous, and speech.
Caribbean, daiquiri, Mediterranean, cemetery, Cincinnati, omelet, pavilion. I write about travel and food for a living.
Hi, my name is CG, and I have never been able to say the word spaghetti.
I'm not even going to mention how I struggled with the word rhythm in my music writing days, and I don't mean dancing, though I suck at that too.
I work every day with government officials, and so I'm often writing about the phrase public officials. So often, in fact, that I just take the word pubic out of my computer's spell check dictionaries. Since I'm not an OBGYN, I never need to write that word, and I never want to accidentally write about pubic officials.
Okay, so all this might not mean anything to most people, but if you, too, can't spell hors d'oeuvre or Caribbean or accommodations, just know that you are not alone. So hey, we always want to talk to you. You can tweet to us anytime, even if you can spell everything right. We're at Splendid Table, or you can find me at @Francis_Lamb. So when I was in culinary school, I took a 6-week course on wines. Now, this was like 15 years ago, and I don't actually drink, so I have forgotten most everything I've learned. So sorry, Professor Colpan. But I do remember one thing. How crazy the Master Sommelier exam seemed. I mean, there are questions like, Imagine you're leaving Winery X. You turn left on the road and walk 200 meters. What vineyard are you standing in? And this test literally goes on for days. So you have the questions like that, and then you're doing random things like you're tasting an unmarked glass of wine, and now you have to tell them what grape it is, who made it, and what year it came from. So it's not surprising that there are only 149 people who have ever passed this test. That means there are only 149 certified master sommeliers in our country. And one of them, Alpana Singh, was actually the youngest woman to ever pass that test. Our contributor Shauna Seaver spoke with her about how she got to where she is.
Alpana, what was your first restaurant job?
Officially, my first restaurant job was a hostess at Baker Square in Carmel.
Now, the last time I checked, Baker Square does not have much of a wine program. No. So how did you become interested in wine? What led you to take the Master Sommelier's exam?
It was out of necessity, actually. And my parents had a business when I was growing up. It didn't do too well. It was, you know, it suffered the effects of the recession. And when it came time to go to college, I mean, there just wasn't any money. That's just what it was, you know. And I looked at the price of college, and I looked at my bank account, I looked at my poor parents, and I just, you know, I'm like, what am I going to do? So I ended up taking a job at this restaurant called Montreal in Monterey, and they originally turned me down for the job because I didn't know anything about wine. And I said, please, I need this job. And so, you know, I'm very stubborn and I don't take no for an answer. So I went and bought a couple books, memorized them, came back and, you know, begged for the job. I was 18. I did the math because I found out, like, okay, well, if I pass this exam, then I could write my own ticket. And I found out about the exam because one of the managers working at this restaurant was studying to become a master sommelier. And so I went to him one night and I said, hey, listen, I'm thinking about, you know, maybe I could take the test. And he knew from tastings that I had a natural palate because I was able to pick out wines and remember once I tasted it that, like, hey, that tasted like the Syrah we tasted 2 weeks ago, but it was the French Syrah, right? And turns out, like, I would be kind of spot on in blind tastings.
Hmm.
So I started studying for the Master Sommelier exam. I passed the advanced exam when I was 21. And then I knew that I would have to, you know, go work at a really nice restaurant to further my education. That's how I landed in Chicago. But truth be told, what originally got me interested in the exam was because I knew that college was not a possibility for me, you know, because of financial reasons, and I didn't want to put myself in debt. I saw my parents struggle with debt, and it's crippling and horrifying. And it still haunts me to this day. Like, you know, I wanted to go to Berkeley. You know, I wanted to get a degree in political science, you know, and I couldn't because the money just wasn't there. But there was this opportunity to take this exam. And I knew that if I applied myself and tried really hard and made the best use of my gifts, that perhaps I could, you know, like I said, write my own ticket. And I have been able to do that.
Now, for people who aren't familiar with the Master Sommelier's exam, this is, it's an undertaking. Can you kind of walk us through it? You know, it's a monster of an exam. And it takes a really special kind of personality to even want to pursue that.
Yeah, no, there was a documentary that was done recently called SOM. It's available on Netflix. It's an extraordinary look at what it takes to pass the test. And it's very accurate, you know. And there's a line in the documentary that says, the exam doesn't make you crazy. You have to be a little crazy to attempt it. And that's true.
And I believe there's now 149 Master Sommeliers
in
the world.
Yes, it's, I mean, I've been in the program since 97, 98, and it's incredible. You know, it used to be this thing that only a few people knew about. And now when people find out I'm a Master Sommelier, it's kind of like, oh my God. Like,
it's really amazing.
I used to have to explain it to people, and now people know about it. You know, so it's come a long way, but it also shows the curiosity and how much our culture as a whole has embraced wine and the study of wine and the proper service of wine. So it's, you know, it's encouraging.
Well, thank you so much, Alpana. This was fascinating talking with you.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Alpana Singh is the owner of the Chicago restaurants The Boarding House, Seven Lions, and Terra and Vine. Shauna Seaver is the author of Real Sweet. And that's our show for this week. Thank you always, always, always for listening. And let me leave you with a little Shel Silverstein. What did the carrot say to the wheat? Let us rest. I'm feeling beat. Our show is produced by APM, American Public Media, You can find information on all the things you heard here today at splendidtable.org. Register for our monthly giveaway and sign up for our email newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen, and it'll make Monday to Friday more delicious for you. Our production team includes senior producer Jennifer Russell, Jenny J. Lou Lukey is our editor and technical director, Chip Walton is our digital associate producer, thanks to Teresa Burgess for pinch hitting this week, and Sally Swift is our managing producer. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.